listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa.
And solar.
And it is, as we prepare for our annual January ice storm. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilbourn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and be sure and listen on Monday when we rebroadcast this same program in case you might want to tell your friends about it. Either way.
Writers' Voices broadcast live on Fridays, 1 p.m. That's where we are right now, and rebroadcast 8 a.m. Monday morning. And our shows also eventually make it onto the web as a podcast at writersvoices.com. So, Mom, who do we have on Writers' Voices today?
Well, today we have a gentleman, Mark Neeson, and he's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and NYU Film School. His background includes children's theater, cattle chores, okay, and a season with a one-ring circus. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? He's been awarded a Raymond Carver Short Story Award and two Pushcart Prize nominations. He serves on the faculty of Chatham University and is a fiction editor at The Fourth River. And this is a most interesting book.
The
most
book
interesting.
Today is Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape by Mark Neeson. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mark.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Monica and Caroline.
Schoolhouse is actually set a little way up the road from here, isn't it?
Yeah, it used to be. It's not there anymore, but it used to be about 15 miles west of Iowa City.
Oh, so what happened? What happened to it?
Well, the building itself was raised about 4 or 5 years ago now.
Uh-huh.
But the land that the schoolhouse was on was about 350 acres of woodland and pasture, and that's still there, very strong, and it's a state park now. It's called Redbird State Park.
Ah.
When's the last time you were there?
Well, I'm really lucky. I get to go. I mean, I'm not living in the Iowa area anymore. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania these days, but each summer I come in for the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and at some point while I'm there, I make it a point to get out to the land again and just walk it. And I mean, I know it really, really well, and I'm always walking it in my head, but it's nice to do it with my feet once in a while, too.
Yes, indeed.
So tell us about what brought you to the Iowa City area, which really is what this book is about.
Yeah, well, initially what brought me there was having learned about the Iowa Writers' Workshop. When I first came, the first summer I had come there, this was back in, let's say, 1991, so we're going 26-odd years ago, the Summer Writing Festival, which I had heard about, and I signed up to take a class, and I'd never done anything like that before in my life, and I was very taken by, you know, just sitting in a room full of people that I didn't have to sort of apologize for who I was or what I was trying to do, and folks that were trying to do the same kinds of things I was, and I was hooked, and then I was lucky enough I applied for the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I was lucky enough to be admitted into it, and coming out to the Midwest, you know, completely changed my life. I was, you know, a New York City boy, and coming out to a rural landscape was something I was extremely intrigued by, and almost from the moment I arrived there, I was like, I need to live out in the corn. I need to live out there, and I was able to find a place. This what was an old one room schoolhouse from the very early 1900s, and surrounded by all this amazing sort of woodlands, and I did it, and that's where I went, and I changed. And the schoolhouse for me was a place that, I mean, it was interesting that at the same time I was going to a master's program and learning how to write, I was also living in this what had once been an elementary school and learning fundamental lessons that I'd never had the opportunity, just having come from a more urban area.
Well, you couldn't have found a better place because Iowa timber woods is magnificent. It really is.
My gosh, yeah. It's a landscape that's just, it's imprinted itself on me.
Yes, Yeah, you could. I could tell that by your story, and it was interesting. The way you wrote, narrative, and then you wrote in there some of your journaling, which was interesting. I thought the way you laid the book out, I would thought was quite interesting.
As I mentioned, you know, this is from a 25 year ago period of time when this is. I look at a year basically when I was living at the schoolhouse, and I structured the book around an academic year so that it starts in the fall and comes around to the fall again. And you know, part of what I was learning was the things that I was writing about day to day as I was interacting with the woodlands and the local, you know, flora and fauna. And so it seemed like it made a lot of sense for me to include a certain part of the journal in the book as well. Also, from a writing standpoint, it allowed me so much license in terms of how to structure a narrative. I could hop in and out of narration and go to journal entries and then let the white space in between them create its own kind of juxtaposition and ultimately a invitation for the reader to be, you know, co-constructing the story alongside with me as they figure out how they fill in the blanks in between the two things that I was sort of having them read as the text.
Mark, had you always journaled, or was this something that you just started when you were doing the master's program?
You know, I had not always done that. I came to writing late. I was actually 30, 31, 32 when I started the program at the university. And I hadn't had the regimen or the awareness of journaling. I think a few years prior to coming to Iowa, I'd lived in Italy, and I think that's where I first started to do any kind of journal writing. And then when I came out to the schoolhouse, it just seemed absolutely natural for me to be writing in a journal. And I got, you know, those old sort of Mead speckled composition books.
Yes, yes.
And it was like, oh, this is, you know, I'm a young kid again in a way, learning. And so putting the entries in those books felt really natural. So it wasn't really, it wasn't so much a part of the MFA program as it was an attempt to try and learn something within the walls of the elementary schoolhouse.
So how did you end up in Italy in the first place?
Well, that's another story. I think one of the parts that we haven't talked about in the book thus far, it's also, not only is it sort of this, you know, white New York City boy trying to find himself in the woods. Part of it is also I was on the lam, if you could call it that, from a long-term love affair that you know that sort of needed to end, and I didn't know how to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I had tried leaving that relationship once before, and I had traveled across the ocean to do that. Venice was a place I had visited for less than a day earlier than that, and knew it was a spot I wanted to live. It was just like you stepped into a maze and a merry-go-round all at once. And so I'd gone there also to get away from New York to an extent, and also to try and, at that point, I was trying to see what it would be like to live around the world in different places. And Venice was the first place I picked, and it was just so right. I stopped wandering. I just stayed there for two to three years. I was there altogether.
You know, it's interesting because when I've been in Venice, I just was there once, but I always thought of it as a place that nobody actually lived.
Yeah, well, it can feel like that because there's, you know, obviously a huge part of the city, even more than when I was there, you know, in the late 80s, is overrun by tourism. And so because of the maze kind of network of the back alleys of the way in which the city is constructed, it's very easy, not necessarily, you know, you could be a half a block away from where you're standing and have no idea what's on in that area and have no way of knowing how to get access to it. The tourists, to a certain extent, stay within a certain given area, but there are some areas of Venice which are very, still very, you know, popular in the sense of of having the original populace. They're getting smaller and smaller, obviously.
Yeah.
There's two or three areas in particular that I think remain with a lot of the flavor of what has been there for centuries. But I ended up living in areas that were sort of middle ground. But there's a lot of residences in Venice. It's,
I guess I assumed that it would
be...
You have
to spend some time in a place and learn the language and learn the map, if you will, and then you get to see some of the secrets, or maybe not secrets isn't a good word, but you get to see some of what's familiar there and what feels...
The history of the place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And real life. I think part of it is I assumed that it was so expensive to live there that it would be hard for an average working person.
Yeah, well, that's why most of the people haven't, you know, the majority of the Venetians have moved to the mainland, have been pushed out by what ends up being speculation. I would say probably, I can't say a percentage, but I wouldn't doubt it's 20-30% of Venice, if not more, is owned by foreign folk that don't necessarily ever live there. So they come there only 1 or 2 months a year, and the rest of the year it's closed down.
What amazes me is
they ended up living there very cheaply, strangely enough.
What amazes me is Venice itself, all the buildings that are surrounded by water, and I don't see how they could endure all these centuries. I mean, it just boggles my mind.
Yeah, well, they're trying. No, and the beauty of it is it's not even on land. I mean, this is created land. It's, you know, pilings that were pounded into the you know, lagoon floor, and you know.
Yeah.
It is amazing. It is.
It's
an architectural and engineering, as well as aesthetic, you know, wonder, frankly.
Yeah.
Well, going from Venice as your first escape to Iowa as your second, I guess shows that you're a man who likes to mix things up a bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, but you also make it sound like there's a lot of conscious thought that goes into it. I think I was just bouncing, if I think about it, from that period of time. I wasn't sure what I was doing in terms of vocation or anything. I just, you know, looking back on it, I can see that there's some sort of pattern to it, sure. I like to travel. I like to be, and more than travel, to actually be able to live in other places for a certain amount of time, so that you could really, you know, really feel that you're acculturating also to an extent.
Well, I think people who live here in Iowa or in the Midwest will appreciate your perspective as an outsider, that you can sometimes see the beauty that we overlook because it's so familiar to us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there is that, and I mean, I think I think that's because I stopped. I mean, I think you're right. It's because I stopped and I
you left.
Settled there for a little bit of time. But, you know, most of the people, you know, certainly I wasn't telling anybody on the East Coast how great it was. You know, we were trying to keep them out of there.
Right. There you go.
I was a little greedy, sort of, in my way. But no, you know, it's like anything. You know, how much do you take something for granted because you see it every day, or how much do you not see what's there because you're speeding by at 70 miles an hour?
You
know, it's always, and that's the hugest lesson of what I think the schoolhouse time did for me, is it taught me what intimacy is in terms of you know, living on a piece of land and figuring out how you belong and you know, being aware of the solar power, as you called it, of how the pond warms up and how long it took for things to melt come spring and all of those things. And then there was the intimacy of learning that the romance of isolating yourself like a Thoreau Walden has its value, but ultimately, you know, the intimacy is, you know, we're herding animals on some basic biological level, and or at least social animals, and being alone isn't our natural way, and I just had to learn how to be intimate with someone else, and that's what the time there really taught me. The hard-earned lessons, I'd have to say. Looking back, you know, the guy in the book sounds a little whiny to me when I think about it, but he was young and he just didn't know.
Well, there's a blurb that in the book that's on the back, too, that I think people will appreciate. Someone once told me that school and life were different. In school, they give you the lessons before the test. In life, it's the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, we pulled that one out for a reason, because I think it really sums up a great deal about what the book does, and ultimately, I think what any of us, I mean, we all have lessons that we have to learn about love and belonging, and I think that quote sort of says that. I think in that respect, I think even though for any reader, I think the book can speak to them. It's not necessarily whether they're in the Midwest or you know, a marginal nature. I mean, all of us have this this need to sort of figure those things out.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Correct. And our guest today is Mark Neeson, author of Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape. It's published by Ice Cube Press, which is one of our favorite presses.
Because it's in Iowa.
It is. You know, you obviously show a lot of appreciation for your publisher as well.
Oh, my God. I can't tell you. I'll scream his name out right now. Steve Semkin. An amazing, amazing individual. And, you know, like I said, I had started writing this book I started writing it while I was still living at the schoolhouse. So over 20 years ago, I started writing it, and I shelved it for different reasons. And then it felt, I can talk about why it felt like it was time to bring it out again. But I had always envisioned this as needing to come out of Iowa and needing to come out from an Iowa publisher. And Steve was, you know, I found him. And he was it. It was just like, this is the match.
This was meant to be.
So, yes, why did you decide now, after 25 years, that it was time?
I think for a couple of reasons. I think one of them, you mentioned in the beginning, you know, we talked about the schoolhouse being raised. Mm. And so I recognized that I had had that treasure of living in that building, that envelope, whatever you want to call it. It was a seed, really, if you want to think about it, for me, and I felt that though the building wasn't standing there anymore, that I was walking around feeling that all the time and knowing what I had. And then I said, well, other people should have that. I shouldn't have that just to myself. So part of it was that, trying to pay homage to what the building was, and the other part of it, I think, came you know, when I had drafted it. Parts of the book in the 90s, you know, some of me was thinking that, well, this is, you know, sort of my own little belly button lint, and what does this story have to say to other people? And I put it on a shelf also to be able to actually arrive at a place emotionally to write it better or write it more honestly. But then it sort of started to occur to me when, you know, we got into the new millennium and everyone was sort of operating on cell phones and internet and Facebook and having all these ways of being connected, I suddenly realized that the time I had spent there to isolate oneself, even though it was only 20-odd years ago, it felt like it was an archived kind of state of being. And so I suddenly was like, wow, this, for people growing up today, the whole idea of being able to be disconnected, to isolate yourself, it's sort of harder. It's really hard to do now. So I was suddenly thinking that maybe the piece it had something to say about a period of time that was already passing. And in that sense, I thought that, oh, well, maybe the book can talk to a new generation as well.
Mm. You know, the history of one-room schoolhouses, I mean, a lot of people don't have any idea what they were.
Right.
But that was 8 grades in one school building, one teacher. That teacher had to be amazing to be able to do that.
Yeah, they had to. But also, I think part of what was happening was I think there was a more communal sense to how the teaching had to work also. Because you had all those grades together, you had younger students with older students, and the younger students would be listening to what was going on the other side of the room with the older students.
Yeah,
and
right.
The older students, you know, took more of an active role of being, you know, young mentors or teachers themselves. And so there was... Yeah, obviously, it required an amazing amount of ability by the teacher in residence, but I think that there was something that
like you say, it was a community. That school was a community, and they all helped one another.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what you're supposed. That's what the community is supposed to do, right?
Right.
Now, Mark, you said that you came out to one of the summer writing classes, which don't have any real prerequisites. It's basically if you sign up and pay your money, you can come. But the Writers Workshop Master's program that you were in is a completely different story. Did you have any idea how, like, what an honor it is to actually even get accepted into that?
I don't think I knew it when I was applying. I mean, when I came out, like I said, I was so dumb. I thought that the Summer Writing Festival was the Writers' Workshop. I had just read about it in some newspaper or magazine, and so I was confused. But I went upstairs to talk to the people there, and they were very kind at the time. Connie Brothers, who's still there, I went up and talked with her, and she said, "Well, you know, yes, this is what the Ira Rise Workshop program is," and she was very kind to also hand me a listing of all the other MFA programs around the country because she knew it was very competitive.
Right.
And my first instinct, like you say, I'm interested in different regions and different types of ecosystems, and so I ended up thinking, well, maybe I'll go to the Southwest and be in a desert, or maybe I'll go to the Northwest and be more in mountains, and I started looking at who was teaching in those programs, and a lot of them had come out of Iowa.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, it all started there. You know, that was
exactly.
the first program only
exactly.
almost close to 80 years ago now.
Oh,
but
gosh.
So then I said, well, maybe there's something about the source here, and I should try. And I was lucky to get in. And actually, I couldn't even go the first time I got admitted. There was other stuff going on in my family life, and I actually couldn't. I asked if I could
defer.
Defer, right? I asked if I could defer, and they said, "Well, you really can't because they base it on the you know, here's the handful of submissions that come in or applications that come in, and we're basing it on how do you rate next to those." So they said you have to apply again.
Ah, wow.
They said probably there's a good chance you'll get past the first cut, but. You know, we can't guarantee, and so I actually got in twice, I guess you could say. So I was listening to the message of saying, you should come here. This is where you should come.
What kind of writing had you been doing previously to this, and had you published at all?
No, I hadn't published anything at all. I had my background prior to this was in more filmmaking, and filmmaking led me to script writing, and so I guess you could say I had done some. I collaborated with a friend who's a director, and we co-wrote scripts. So in that sense, I guess the work went public. Some of my writing went public, but as far as prose was concerned, and that's what I think I learned in the process of going to film school, is that I actually liked that medium wasn't my best medium. Doing all that collaboration with a bunch of people, I did much better. Sitting alone in a room, and so then I sort of then started working in prose, and I think I really started to try and make that work when I was living in Italy. Mm. And again, that was my late 20s by then. I think all of the creative work I've done has been just variations on a theme. As a young child, I was a visual artist. That was where my leanings were. So they're all just different forms of expressions. It just happens to be this medium. But I think at most what I was writing, I had started to write when I was in Italy, were what I would call short stories. And those were the pieces that I had submitted to the Writers Workshop to try and get accepted. So that's as much as I had really started at that point.
And what kind of work did you how did the workshop change your writing? Let's put it that way. Did it change the type of things you're writing
question about?
Or
I think it's in various different ways. I mean, I think there is, you know, there's the argument going back and forth about whether this is something that can be taught anyway. One of the largest things I would say, at least for me, was finding that community, finding other people that were trying to do the same thing. I think, you know, the question of whether your writing gets better is really a question of whether you put in the time at the desk. Obviously, you have to have a certain amount of nascent, leanings toward this, or talent, whatever you want to call it initially. But it's the tenacity that's going to make you a better writer. But being exposed to certain teachers there, and I think for the first time in my life, recognizing, oh, wow, this is something that I could make a lot. This is something I could do with my life. You know, that in Iowa City and in Iowa as a state, you know, writing is something that is really respected. And so there was that component, I think, that I saw it as something that was actually viable. And then I think what changed me most, I would say, within the program had to do with my interactions with James Allen McPherson as a teacher and a mentor. And he just passed away this past year, and I actually dedicate the book to him. He had a huge effect on me, and not so much in terms of, you know, the craft and of putting together sentences, but more importantly about seeing your work as being in the context of a time and a period and a place, and what is it that you have to say to the world? And, you know, how is writing also, what component of it has a civic responsibility?
Now, Mark, we've heard over the years a lot about how, particularly in the early years at the Writer's Workshop, the workshopping of a piece could get pretty... the criticism could be pretty cruel at times.
I think that's something you hear because that may be how it's received by some people. I think, you know, different professors have different philosophies of how to teach and different tonalities of how they might teach. The intent always, of course, is to try and help people get better. Some of that may have to do with what the expectations are of the individual when they go into the room. But the other part is just the plain thing about, you know, you're putting up work which is very vulnerable. You're putting up work that's not finished yet. And you're just learning your lessons. And so, yeah, if you're vulnerable, certainly if you don't have a good hold on what your ego is, that could be problematic for some people. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'd actually watched some people get hurt creatively, but I don't think that's the intention of what a workshop does. I don't think that's where it comes from. If you look at, I mean, even the etymologies of these things, a workshop is about, in the dictionary it talks about, it's about a problem solving. And so I think there's, at least this is my take on it, I think it's all about positive. And taking whoever, as a teacher, let's say, put it that way, I see my task as bringing a writer from wherever they are at this juncture to the next plateau. And it's not about pushing them down the hill.
Well, I think a lot of times some writers will be so in love with what they've written, and they take it in there thinking everybody is going to think it's the best thing ever, and it's, you know, it's going to be a bestseller, and they get they can't handle if that's not the reaction that they get.
Yeah, well, yeah. And again, that just speaks to a certain youngness, let's say, or a certain naivete in terms of being able to read your own work yet. And being, you know, the workshop is perfect because you have a dozen people to give you input. And eventually, you don't need a dozen people. You need maybe three who are good readers for you, or then you need one person who's a mentor. And then eventually, you have enough distance from your own work or objectivity on it that you can see it from apart. But and even at this point, no matter where you are in the writer, you know, you finish writing and it's midnight and you're ready to call Nobel. Fruit, you know, then you wake up in the morning a little more sober and you look at it and it's like, oh no, there's more work that needs to be done on this. And I think that's maybe one of the biggest things that a workshop will teach you is that it's a drafting process. It's about doing sketch after sketch after sketch. And somehow, you know, I think in visual arts we understand that, and somehow because all of us can write, we think that it should be done or done quicker, but it's a craft like any other one that you have to make a practice.
Now, Mark, with all the hundreds of writers that we've talked to in the 10 years we've been doing this show, there seem to be two main schools of thought in terms of kind of work style, where the one is that first drafts you write as quickly as possible. You don't do any editing. You just pour it out on the page, and then you go back and work things over as many times as needed. And the other one is that you craft each sentence, each paragraph, each page as you go.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, probably the numbers pan out that way, that there's sort of like half-half in terms of how people process.
So which one are you?
For me, I'm a very slow writer. I don't think I just take a long time to do things and think about things, and I'm slow at most things in my life. That's one of the things that talks about in the book, in Schoolhouse, is that, you know, I was very myopic as a child, and I'm very slow in terms of picking up on things. Mm. But I think also maybe some of the tools that we use now to do our writing are changing the way in which people are writing. The whole idea of, like, you know, even having a knowing what is your first draft anymore is hard, because people keep tinkering on things because you can on a computer.
Mm. True.
But I think probably there are some, you know, I think there is those who write quickly and those who write slowly. I think there seems to be a certain, obviously
a divide.
On the spectrum there.
Yeah. And do you think that the fact that we can edit so effortlessly, you know, in terms of the logistics of editing now with word processing and computers, compared to, you know, typing, you know, handwriting a manuscript, typing it up, crossing things out, editing, having it retyped, and how tedious that was. Do you think that has made the end product better or worse?
I think probably neither. Long run, ultimately, you're going to make your, you know, the thing that the public is ultimately seeing is the thing that's finished and polished. How it got to that state is a whole other question, but I do think, though, that people are getting into the editing or mindset, or even copy editing mindset, a lot sooner than they did historically. And I think that does affect something in people's process or how they think things should proceed. There's a great value of being able to type, you know, do something handwritten and then typewrite it up and have it come back to you in another form, and then to look at that. So at least I can say that in my process, I think, mm-hmm. you know, the gene pool is probably shifting now as you know, the writers that are coming up have you know, all started on
computers. Yeah.
Of how you read anything is not, you know, scanning left to right anymore. People have a much different form, and you're seeing that effect in the forms of how people are telling stories. You know, there's far more multi-narratives that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, that's a shift in the culture and the attention span too, maybe.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Mark Neeson, author of Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape. Mark, why don't you read a section from the book so our listeners can get an idea of the flavor of your writing?
Okay, great. That would be a delight. Actually, I think what I'll do is I'll read a snippet. The book's, it doesn't really have a table of contents. It has what's called a lesson plan. And that just seemed organic to the subject matter. But, you know, each chapter is, you know, it could be named after things you'd find in elementary school, subjects like geography or civics or spelling, anatomy, social studies, you know, what I did on my summer vacation, things like that. And I think I'll read a little piece that comes out of history, since we were talking about how listeners may or may not know much about the schoolhouses. And I'll start with maybe a little snippet of a journal entry, so you'll get a feel for how that works in the. Okay.
All right.
5 December. Drove over to Colonna's grocery this afternoon for bulk grains and sorghum. The Amish had turned out their cattle to graze on corn stubble, taking advantage of the melt. Their laundry is out again, too. Drab dresses, dish towels, corsets. Down the road, children's boots on the stoop outside their schoolhouse. I pulled over to watch dismissal. the kids walking the muddied roads beneath their wide-brimmed hats and bonnets, their books in arm. Stole a peek in the window. One room, like mine, yet crowded with desks. A squat brown wood stove in one corner, and a whole wall of blackboard scrawled with arithmetic and Bible verses, erasures. And I, at the time, I went back to the schoolhouse and was thinking about where would the blackboards been in my schoolhouse. So then I go to I'll skip now to a spot where I go to the, it was actually the Iowa Historical Society, to the library there. And with the help of a librarian, I was led to a topographical map of Johnson County, dated 1900, and divided into its 20 townships. I ran my fingers over the map's grid west of Iowa City until I found a road that looked like Black Diamond. At the time, it was dubbed Old Man's Creek Road, and the road followed the creek, and the creek branched to the north amid a cluster of ridges and trees, just like it did at Redburg's Farm's edge today. That point on the map was nestled in the southwest corner of what was then called Union Township. From there, I went to the microfilms, scanning county superintendent records. It felt like I was a detective in a novel, rummaging through dusty files and shelves for clues. One roll referenced teachers' annual reports, and so I asked the librarian. "Oh, we've got the original of those," she said, "back over here." We walked to the rear of the library, where she climbed a stepladder toward a high shelf. "Well, how far back do you want?" "I don't know," I said, "as far back as you've got." One by one, she pulled down five cumbersome ledgers and laid them out on a wooden table. Each was tied with twine and bound in faded soft leather. A few of their corners had worn through, raw threads of cloth peeking out. Carefully, I slid the most recent book toward me and undid the brown knot. And lifting its cover, I almost expected moths to float up into the air. What I found instead were yellowed pages, hundreds of them. I flipped to the section marked Union Township and then back through the years until in 1956 I found a name I recognized, Jim Walters, a local birdwatcher I knew. Mm-hmm. Age listed him as 8 years old then, and his sister Julie at age 10. And off to the right was their mother's signature, Paige Walters. 13 students were listed on the roster for that year, ranging from ages 5 to 13. And the preceding page recorded their teacher's signature and the school's heading. My school had a name after all, Union Number 9. Near the bottom of the page was a space for suggestions concerning supplies, and the teacher, perhaps not knowing yet that 1956 would be Union Number 9's last year of classes, wrote, "I'd like to see 4 to 6 new chairs to fit the height of a recitation table, a hectograph, some cement or gravel around the door, and less mice." I continued paging backwards, checking the Walters kids' attendance through previous years until their names disappeared into other names, the record sifting back to the Second World War, the Depression, and World War I. And with each successive leisure, the school marm's calligraphy grew more flowery, their names murmuring like music, Isla Wade and Dorothy Driscoll, Luella and Consolata, Daisy and Grace. Meanwhile, the pages themselves became more and more brittle, separating from bindings, fading, crumbling. And then in 1911, all the names gave out. I turned the page forward again. January 8th, 1912. Union Number 9 is born into history. I closed my eyes and tried to imagine the day. January the 8th, the dead of winter, must have been below zero, even without wind chill. And leaning into that wind comes Anna Rarrett, the new teacher, arriving at the schoolhouse past dawn to start a fire and haul water from the creek for the children's basin. She sets down the bowl and the bucket, pauses, then reaches for the broom. Though she'd come and anxiously swept the floor the last evening, she does so again. So many mice droppings. She sits and stokes the stove, quietly watching her breath in the air, trying to melt the snow from her skirt bottoms. She's thinking about her forenoon lessons, thinking about what she'll do with her $42 pay come the end of the month. At 8:50, she glimpses Maynard and Hazel Thomas trudging their way up the road, all bundled up and holding hands, their mittens a bright red against the snow. She jumps up and writes her name clearly on the blackboard, steps back, then adds Miss and the date. When the children finish kicking their boots against the stoop, she shows them into the cloakroom and where to set their dinner pails. At 9:05, her other two students, the Halstead children, they still haven't arrived. She glances out the window one last time and decides to begin. She clears her throat and says, "All right, children, this is your new Jones reader. Now turn to page..." "Excuse me? Hello?" said the librarian. "Huh? It's closing time." "Oh, I'm sorry," I said. "I must have drifted off." I returned the ledgers to their top shelves, then slowly drove home in darkness. By the time I rounded the last bend toward the schoolhouse, flurries were falling in the cast of headlights. Once inside, I hung my coat on a hook and turned up the thermostat. Too cold now for the fireplace alone. I pulled over a chair near the floor grating and I warmed my toes. And the floor joists creaked with the heat and the wind outside pressing against the walls. I'll stop there.
And that was Mark Neeson reading from Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape. Now, Mark, whenever you write memoir, anyone who writes memoir, you have to deal with the fact that you're writing about real people who may still be in your life or may not. Now, you know...
Did I deal with that?
Yeah, how did you deal with that? How were, like, the woman that you were... the relationship you were trying to end...
Right.
How did she react to this book, or are you still in touch, or do you know, or?
I don't know. The last we were in touch was in 2001. Again, she was living in New York City, and it was soon after 9/11 that I just felt I needed to make contact. She had had children that lived down near that area, and so that was the reason why I got in touch. And, but how she's going to react to this book, I don't know. I don't know. I did tell you, I don't even know. She may not even be alive now. Mm. It's possible, but my guess is that she is. She's the one person in the book that I actually didn't sort of check with. Maybe that's, again, me not fully being emotionally ready to deal with that. Or, I don't know, I just had a feeling that I think I do her honor in the book. I don't think that there's any dishonor that's done to that. But pretty much so everyone else that's in the book, I've sort of checked with. I wrote the sections and I asked them, can you live with this? And because I didn't want to change names.
Right.
Yes, in memoir, you, there is a certain amount of fabrication, obviously. In that scene that I read, I was fabricating a scene of what it might have been like at the schoolhouse that morning. I have no real sense of that. And even if I am writing about actual conversations or scenes where I was interacting with other people, you have to approximate dialogue. I think any reader sort of understands that when they're reading. Nobody had a
recorder going.
but for the most part, you are bound by trying to make something as factual / truthful as you can.
And of course, you can't write dialogue exactly the way it was spoken anyway, because
no,
it would
can't.
Be too boring.
Everybody understands that. Nobody, yeah. Nobody expects differently.
Right.
But I do think that, if you are publishing something and calling it nonfiction or creative nonfiction or memoir, there's a certain amount of ethics involved here. And sometimes even what you think is going to be problematic is not. Part of the book I'm writing is about some... you can call them skeletons in the closet or certain things that weren't spoken about within my family. Actually part of the reason why I did write them is because I think secrets and denials about the past doesn't necessarily help people. Hmm. And it turned out in truth, some of the people in my family, they found this really useful. We've been able to have conversations since that we never could have had prior.
Mm-hmm.
So that design of some of that fear is a fear of how somebody's going to react, and a lot of that has to do with privacy and disclosure more than it has to do with whether something is factual or truthful, I think. Mm.
Yes, definitely.
We don't always remember things as they really were, do we?
Yeah, well, the point is also, I mean, Frank Conroy was another teacher I had at the workshop, and though he was only teaching fiction, he once said, you know, because he has written a memoir, he said, you know, I'm writing my, you know, you're writing your book. You know, it is not going to be the exact thing that somebody else experienced because they didn't experience it as you, and they can write their own book if they like. Everybody's, I mean, you and I, the three of us can talk about what's happened over the last 20 minutes over this conversation. We'll have at least three versions.
Absolutely. You know, I had one a writer talk about, she wrote a memoir about Hope Adelman, whom you probably know from the Writer's Workshop.
She's taught up there.
Yeah. And so she wrote about, you know, losing her mother at a very young age. And in the first book, she was talking about showing it to her father and you know, being a little concerned because there were, you know, aspects of his parenting that maybe weren't, as a single dad after that maybe, you know, didn't sound that great. But the only thing he disagreed with was some very specific detail about a fur coat that her mother had. That was the only thing he wanted her to change.
Yeah, and that's it, what people get hung up on. You know, and then maybe it was the fact of the color of it or the make of it. Who knows? But
yeah.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Broke off there for a sec.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and you can't predict that as a writer how someone is going to react, and you have to get over some of those fears yourself. You know, are you willing to go somewhere? And that's part of the vulnerability of writing. I don't put it this way. I don't think I treat anyone. I think I treat myself far harder than anyone else in the book. That's in the book. And that's part of the deal of writing memoir is being willing to be vulnerable.
Yeah, you show yourself naked, really.
Yeah. Or you show your, at least hopefully you're showing that there's been a some kind of trajectory in your life, and you got from there to now, or then, you know, there to here, or then to now, and hopefully there's been some movement there of some sort.
Now, Mark, are you teaching at the Iowa Summer Writing Festival this year?
This summer I am, actually. Yes. Yeah, I am.
And
I'm going to teach a couple of weekend classes and one. I'm actually teaching a week-long course of on memoir, and I end up calling it Self and Society, and there's the actual point of it. You know, how do you not just make it about yourself, but find something communal?
And what are your weekend courses that you're teaching?
The weekend courses, I think I'm teaching one weekend that is on process and progress, which looks at not just, you know, a lot of the focus goes on what you write, but not necessarily on how you write. So we look a lot about how our process works, and you know, frankly, if you can't get to the desk, you're never going to write anyway. So those, we look at that specifically, and how, you know, there's times you write well and times you don't write well. How do you figure out which are the times that are, you write well and recreate that for yourself more consistently? The other weekend class I'm teaching, I think I'm doing a new one this year that's about thinking about place as how place is a character, how you know, you're right, you know, place-based writing, which is the majority. That's sort of the core of what we teach at the MFA program that I teach at in Pittsburgh at Chatham University.
I was interested to read the part where you talk about how you noticed that the integration of the timber, the woods, and the atmosphere is with writing, how they go together.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, any, you ask any little kid, and you say you put two things together, they'll come up with a story, you know. So that links the two of them. So that your imagination can make a metaphor out of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, I think finding the ones that feel apt and at least truthful. And I think, yeah, part of it, as I was saying, I was at the same time I was learning those lessons at schoolhouse, I was learning how to write. And so I think I was seeing that in the landscape as well, and learning how to read a landscape and how to see patterns. And it's not all unlike how do you see how words create patterns on a page.
Well, speaking of metaphors, I just wanted to read one of my favorite metaphors from your book. It's on page 95, where you're talking about owls.
Mm-hmm.
And you write, they seemed to the dark sky what sharks were to deep water.
Mm.
That one struck me as very...
It's from the point of view of a rodent.
Right.
No, I always... I love owls, too, because there's something that you... They're a bird that you know they're there, but you rarely actually see them head on. It's just always sort of out of the corner of your eye.
Owls become an important bird in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I was very taken by owls.
Yeah.
And I noticed, too, that when you, I think you hit a coon at one point, and it subsequently died, and you felt really bad. You took it to the side of the road and laid it down, and you imagined that there were two of them, and the one was able to get away, and you noticed that one that was had gotten away was probably watching you, and you could feel that, yeah.
I also wanted to mention that there was one person that you write about in your book. I don't know if he was in the workshop with you or was teaching. I can't remember, but it was somebody whose name I recognized, whose work I'd read, and who I actually thought I saw once at Prairie Lights when I was in Iowa City. And that was...
Was it Chris?
It was Chris, yes.
Chris' character?
Yes.
Chris Offit.
Chris Offit, yep.
Yeah. When I came to Iowa, he had finished the program already, but I got to meet him, and he did. He helped a lot with first introducing me to the woods, and I actually acknowledge him in the book for he had talked to someone else who had been in the schoolhouse prior to me and told them that this is probably the guy who should move in there, and so I owe a lot to Chris as well as writing lessons too from him, frankly, but I learned what the woods could be in many respects from early woods walks I took with him.
Now, is he still writing?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's writing. He's down in Oxford, Mississippi now.
Okay.
And for a number of years he went out west and was doing some writing for television. But he recently, this past year, he published another memoir about his father. He had a very interesting father who was a professional, I guess you could call it, he calls it my father the pornographer. his father wrote books, and some of them were pornography, and a lot of them were in that vein of
erotica.
Erotica, I guess that's the way. But he was a very imaginative one, from what I understand, and a very, very prolific one.
Oh, that's interesting.
It in all kinds of different genres as well. But that's a whole other story about he and his clearing out his father's home.
Mm. Yeah, you say here that the most precious the most precious value of any heirloom is its story, and you know I never thought about that, but that's exactly true.
Yeah, well, you drive down the roads and somebody's having a garage sale, and at some point all this stuff turns into it's in cardboard boxes, two for a buck, and you walking up to it, you don't know what it, the real value of it isn't the thing; it's the story behind it, the things that are attached to the object.
Yeah, that got me thinking.
It's the story plus the emotion.
Right, right. It got me thinking about all the stuff that my kids are going to have to go through.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, you did it for your mother, and the problem is that we kept a lot of it.
Yeah, right. Well, there was a lot of value. There's a lot of valuable things.
I know.
But the value in history, because my great-grandfather was a judge in Iowa, and my grandfather was in Jasper County.
Uh-huh.
Central Newton, Iowa, around Newton.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
And we have a lot of correspondence from him, in the late 1800s between he and his brother who had moved out to Montana, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And also among other members of the family, a lot of correspondence from a soldier in the Civil War writing to his sister who was married to the judge or something. Anyway, one of the, I get mixed up with the who was married to who and the family and so forth. But a lot of letters and postcards and even scrapbooks
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, I know. Yeah.
Well, now look at them.
Yeah. So I want to ask one last question about the classes you're teaching this summer at the festival. Do you still have openings? Do you know if our listeners are interested?
I believe so. My guess is that, as far as I know, Amy Margolis, who is the queen of the festival, I think they are just actually putting out the catalog at this juncture.
I've already gotten an email about it, so...
Oh, did you? Okay,
yeah.
Then that may be that registrations have started to open, so I would, you know, have people telephone or look it up online.
Right, because it's a class size limited to 12, I think.
A lot of writers are, you know, they put things off, so they may not get away, but I'd be happy to have somebody in a class if they come on down, so... Sure, look it up.
Well, Mom and I have both...
Look up all the others. So many talented educators at that festival.
We've both been there. Mm-hmm. I've gone at least 5 times, I think, over the years.
Okay, so I don't have to tell you anything. You know.
But the problem is that I'm inspired, and I think I'm going to write, and then I don't do anything until the next time I go. So that's...
Well, that's why when you get... Well, now, there's other people in the class, right?
Right, right.
So you just have to share each other's names and emails and...
Encourage.
You know, that, it is the challenge. How do you sustain the in that sense
yeah,
of
the enthusiasm
and energy and that is indeed that is the truth. It's hard to write.
Yeah.
I mean, we think it's easy, but it's one of the hardest things.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's the hard, but it's hard to sit alone in a room. Pascal talked about that. Mm. You know.
Well, Mark,
ago, if not longer, that's one of the hardest things, and it's getting harder. Getting harder to be able to sit alone in a room.
Well, in the 20 seconds we have left, what's your next writing project, Mark?
The next writing project is I'm working on a novel now that's called Houdini's Heirs, as in like when you inherit something.
Ah.
And it's set in Coney Island in a sideshow, and Houdini is in it too. He makes a couple of cameo appearances. But it's a modern-day sideshow,
that's right.
I guess I could call it call it a sideshow romance for now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Mark Neeson, author of Schoolhouse, Lessons on Love and Landscape. If you're listening on Friday, stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild. And Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom?
I do, about those teachers in the one-room school. The world seldom notices who the teachers are, but civilization depends on what they do and what they say.
Thank you for being with us.
Oh, Monica, Caroline, thank you. This was a lovely conversation. And I look forward to bumping into you at the Summer Writing Festival.
I hope so. I hope
you
so.
You too. Come up and say hey.
Okay. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.